WFSU-FM now presents a visit to the Village Square. This public forum was recorded at Tallahassee's St. John's Episcopal Church on February 28, 2013.
I'm Leslie Smith. On behalf of the Tallahassee Democrat and the Village Square, it's my pleasure to welcome you to Students, Safety, and the Second Amendment, a community conversation on a national debate. Moderating tonight's discussion is Paul Fleming, the Tallahassee Democrat's politics and policy editor.
Good evening, and welcome to this discussion. I look forward to it this evening. Commissioner, if I get dinged, there's going to be a problem. So I'm before I start with introductions, we're here tonight discussing an issue that prompted this discussion. It's a tragedy on December 14 in Newtown, Connecticut. Sandy Hook Elementary School, on that day, 28 people died. There were 20 children. Four teachers, a principal, school psychologist, Nancy Lanza, and her son were dead at the end of that day. Our discussion is going to range over many topics, some of them particular to Sandy Hook, but that's what prompted us to be here tonight, and I think it's appropriate before we start for us to have a moment of silence and remember that tragedy and keep that in our thoughts as we have our discussion tonight. So if you would join with me, please, for a moment of silence before we get started. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad all of you are here. I look forward to a great conversation that's going to be led by a fantastic group of folks up here that each bring a particular area of expertise that I think will add to our conversation. I'm going to shortly introduce those who are with us today. First, I have John Hunkiar, who is the chief of the Leon County Schools Department of Safety, Security, and Emergency Management. 22 years in school law enforcement. In 2006, he joined us here at the Leon County School District. Glad to have you here, sir. Brant Copeland is the pastor, First Presbyterian Church. We're going to gang up on you. I'm a fallen Presbyterian, but Reverend Copeland does still accept me, I believe. I have not yet been excommunicated from the Presbyterian Church.
We have extremely low standards.
The Reverend Copeland has been the pastor at Tallahassee's First Presbyterian Church since 1985, and we welcome you here, Reverend Copeland. Chief Walter McNeil is here with us. Very glad to have him here. He is the police chief for the city of Quincy. We all know him in Tallahassee as he served as the police chief here in Tallahassee. He also has served as secretary of the state of Florida's Department of Corrections, as well as the Department of Juvenile Justice. Thank you, Chief. We certainly appreciate having you here. Next to Chief McNeil is Gary Kleck. He is the, and I'm going to read this off. Do you have to read this as well? The David J. Bordua Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida State University. He is the author of Point Blank, Guns and Violence in America, as well as a number of other books. He is an accomplished researcher in guns and violence in America. He's testified before Congress, before state legislators. He is a wonderful resource we have here in town, and I welcome you, Dr. Kleck. Thank you for being here. Also on our panel is Reggie Garcia. He's 18 years of experience in the Capitol, four governors, with the cabinet members. He's also an attorney, a clemency lawyer. I appreciate you being here, Reggie, to bring some expertise on the justice system to our discussion tonight. That's our panel. Let me tell you how we're going to proceed. I want to, again, emphasize that we're going to have a conversation among our panelists, and as we conclude, then open up to questions that we're going to receive from you and through the social media and online. Also, open that up to some questions from the audience as well. But we're going to have a conversation. We're going to talk about some scenarios. As I said, we're here because of what happened on December 14th in Newtown, Connecticut. But we want to talk about our nation as a whole, our state, and our city. And we're going to talk about some scenarios, some possibilities, some areas of discussion. I'm going to direct my initial inquiries to each member of our panel. But we're going to have a conversation up here as well that's going to range across. But I want to cover many aspects of this, and I hope that we'll have. I'm certain that we'll have a wonderful conversation. John, let's begin with you. I want to look at what happened in Sandy Hook. This tragedy happened at an elementary school. It was locked. There were many similarities with policies, as I understand them, in the Leon County School District. There was not a resource officer on site at Sandy Hook Elementary School. What our reaction to these we react immediately to these tragedies. There was immediate reaction in Tallahassee and Florida. In addition to the emotional outpouring, Superintendent Jackie Pons made himself very visible in the days after. Tallahassee Police Department did so as well. What do you do? What's appropriate for our school district to do in reaction, in reviewing our policies? What can we learn from a single incident, or do we not try to react to a single incident? Talk to me about what our policies are, John, in the Leon County School District, and what your review system is when something like this happens.
First, thank you for having me. This particular day is very vivid in my mind. As the events were unfolding, we were taking calls from parents, from the media, and the first appropriate reaction is obviously to send your thoughts and prayers to where the event is occurring. We do want parents to be very well versed at what the reaction would be to an event like that should something happen at their child's school. Obviously, since that event, it has caused us to entertain and look at many different suggestions, some of them extreme, some of them very common sense approach. We've been asked what we do different because of it or what we're doing additionally, and the answer to that is we're really not doing a lot additional in terms of new procedures, but what we're clearly doing is making sure that everything we have in place, we're doing as good as we can. We want to make sure that the parents know that most all of our people in our district, our parents are as well, or had kids at one time there. And it's as important to us for our children in those classrooms as it is for those parents. So overall, we've had great support from our board. Our board chair, Ms. Bowen, is here this evening. And they put security is the top priority in our district. But in sum, we review everything that we've done and anything that's born out of this that's affordable and doable and in the best interest of safety, we'll do.
John, I have a son who's a student in an elementary school in Leon County Schools. When I go to his school during the school day, the entrances to the playground are locked. All the doors save for the front door is locked. And before I go anywhere, I present my Florida driver's license and go through what I presume is some sort of immediate background check on who I am. Tell me about the procedures we have in place. And in relation to if there's any immediate lesson from Sandy Hook, it was locked down too. Adam Lanza shot his way into Sandy Hook Elementary School. There was no resource officer there. Superintendent Pons has proposed getting funding for resource officers in elementary schools. City Commissioner Scott Maddox and the Tallahassee Police Department have stepped up their patrols of elementary schools in the aftermath of Sandy Hook. But let's talk about some particular policies and what the case is here in Leon and if there's anything that we have learned immediately or that makes us reflect on what our policies are.
You mentioned elementary schools, clearly the most vulnerable population. What's very important to us is the access control to those facilities. Being able to control to get to a single point of entry, especially during the school day. Probably even more important than that is the supervision that goes on at these schools every day. Security professionals use the term natural surveillance. The right people watching things happen, and if they notice something out of the ordinary, that information gets acted on. The check that you talked about is a sex offender predator check, and in Florida that's regulated by the Jessica Lunsford Act. We are proponents of putting a law enforcement officer on every campus. We have a school resource deputy program 32 years in existence here in the county. It's not just having an armed person on campus, but it's all of the things that that position brings. The ability to bring information to somebody of trust that has all the resources and the network of the community to act on those. I hope it comes up here tonight. It's very, very high priority with our board, as well as me, as well as U.S. Attorney reviewing actions, is the area of mental health. The ability to solve those problems before they present, especially in a school. And I know that we'll hear about the likelihood and the science behind the numbers and all of that, but we do believe in the value of school resource deputies at the schools. We do believe in high security, diligence to that, as well as still maintaining the feel of a school and a community, in a place you want to go, in a place that's open. So pretty much that's it.
Dr. Kleck, you had something you wanted to add to that?
Well, the problem I have when people say we need a police officer in every elementary school is I never hear it accompanied by the statement, and I will aggressively push for tax increases to pay for it. In the absence of tax increases, and that's probably a pretty good presumption, in the absence of tax increases, putting one more police officer in an elementary school means moving the existing police officers from somewhere else. It doesn't mean just adding one on top of all the other police officers elsewhere, which means basically you have to ask yourself, is the place from which that officer is being removed, even if it's for just part of the day, is it a higher crime place or a lower crime place than elementary schools? Well, in fact, you can hardly imagine a place less likely to have a shooting, Newtown notwithstanding, than an elementary school. So what that means is you're almost invariably going to be moving a police officer from a high-crime neighborhood or a place where they really need that police officer to a place where they have very little need.
Let's
again,
talk
Newtown notwithstanding.
We have resource officers, and help me understand, Mr. Hunkyar, how the program works. In our middle schools and high schools, though these are officers of the Leon County Sheriff's Office, in our case here in Leon County Schools, is it a distinct program, a distinct arm of the Sheriff's Office there that the resource officers are a part of?
Absolutely. Out of their juvenile services division, the School Resource Deputy Unit, very specific, very separate from a traditional response, as you might have the idea of a police officer. The comments very well taken in terms of pulling an officer, putting him somewhere there. If you look at the staffing of a school, a principal, a school nurse, a teacher, a custodian, we see the value of the officer in terms of instruction, interaction, teaching students how to interact with law enforcement. Very true. Our schools, our elementary schools, have literally no crime. If you pulled the crime data and applied it to the model for a neighborhood requiring an additional officer for a patrol, it would never bear out. But all of those other things, mediating parental disputes, custody disputes, issues, traffic control, safety, education, and, God forbid, the worst-case scenario.
Right.
That presence, we do believe, also deters violent crime from coming on there. So the presence of an officer may not show exactly all the crime that shows to necessitate that need, but you also have to look at what's being prevented.
Dr. Kleck, let me return to you as we pursue another area. With the headlines, the 24-hour coverage when tragedies like this happen, it feeds our emotional response to what is undoubtedly a very emotional event. If you look at how our gun policy has come into place, you see it's driven by reaction. The political assassinations of the 60s, an assassination attempt on President Reagan. You see our laws follow those in reaction. That's not the best. As someone who watches policy happen up at the Capitol here, I want to see some numbers. You can help us look at that. While we, by the headlines, would conclude that we're in a more violent time. There's gun deaths, mass shootings on a regular basis. The numbers bear out that we're on a long crime decline, long decline in homicides by gun as well that match that decline in crime. Talk to us about what, in general, you see about mass killings in particular and where that fits in the policy discussion about quantifiable facts and where, how we ought to use that to drive our look at policy going forward.
Right. On your previous point that crime has been declining for years, the question we ought to be asking is not what's been going wrong lately, but what's been going right lately, and let's do some more of that. And something has obviously been going right for quite a while. Crime has been declining or stable since the early 90s. As to the reaction to mass shootings, the first and natural reaction is fear and anger. Fear that it'll happen to our kids or somebody like that, and anger at the people who are responsible. I don't know of any good public policy for dealing with crime that ever came out of either fear or anger. It just leads to bad policy. Which is why I worry when people say, let's do something and let's do it right now. That's the last thing you ought to do. You ought to do something when, you know, the smoke is cleared, so to speak, and people can start thinking a little more rationally, a little more calmly than before.
Well, let me ask you about that. If our premise is we should look at those numbers, the interesting thing to me about what we know about guns and what we know about guns and violence in America is that there's a lot that we don't know. This is your area. This is what you do. Paint for me the parameters of what we do know about guns and gun ownership in the United States, what the holes are there, why that is, and what we can do going forward. Is there need for more data-driven research?
I disagree that we don't know much. We know a lot. We just choose not to pay much attention to it.
Okay.
We make policy. In connection with the Newtown shooting, the focus from a good deal of the news media outlets was on assault weapons. It wasn't always clear why, but at least one of the three guns the killer had was arguably an assault weapon. It was a semi-automatic rifle. And so immediately the policy suggestion was let's ban assault weapons, which were mostly military-style kind of looking semi-automatic guns. Well, less than 1% of the gun crimes in America are committed with assault weapons. It's really, really rare. More to the point, on the rare occasions when they are used, it doesn't make a difference that it was that kind of a gun versus some other kind of a gun. The only difference between assault weapons and other semi-automatic guns is the assault weapons look different. They look more like machine guns. They'll have plastic stocks, and they'll have a pistol grip on the front, and they'll look more like something Rambo would use in a military combat. But they don't function any differently from the unbanned guns, semi-automatic guns, that are not labeled assault weapons. So that's one thing we know. It's rare that they're used. And when they're used, it doesn't make any difference. They don't function any differently from the unbanned counterparts.
Well, let me encourage a conversation here. Chief McNeil, you've been a part of the task force work that Vice President Joe Biden has undertaken at the behest of President Obama. It was a number of initiatives that the president has proposed and taken. You were quoted today in our newspaper in stories that we had about your interest in closing that, returning to that ban on assault rifles that we've now been lapsed for 10 years after the Brady bill sunsetted on that. Talk to us about your position on what are called assault weapons. And for me and for what Dr. Kleck raised there as well, we seem to get lost in terminology about this. What if I understand correctly, an assault weapon or even an automatic rifle is a matter of some small amount of change, mechanical change with a weapon. Where do you come from in your perspective, both of what your work on the national level now and also as a law enforcement officer in our community here, about what that, where we should be going with that?
Well, first, thank you for having the forum and giving us all the opportunity to talk in a civil way. about these issues and perhaps the differences that we have. My position, born of the many years of being a police officer and trying to make sure that we keep our community safe, one of the primary reasons, this goes back well beyond 1994 when the assault weapon ban was put in play. Those of us in law enforcement were very much concerned about our officers being outgunned in many instances on the streets of Tallahassee and all around the country. In fact, the assault weapons are the weapons of choice of gang members that we come in contact with. And we have had an increasing number of police officers killed each year. In fact, this year, I believe the number is something in the neighborhood of about 70 police officers killed feloniously with weapons. The highest number of officers killed, total 145 this past year. The issue that we have, quite honestly, is, for example, I represent the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and we are an organization made up of 20,000 police leaders. And when you start talking about police departments, now I'm the police chief in Quincy, Florida. My officers are going to be outgunned 99% of the time when they come in contact with persons with assault weapons. We had recently, I say recently, in the last 5 years or so, right here in Tallahassee, Tallahassee police officer pulls a person over. They get out, father and son, open up with assault weapons on the officer. All he can do is retreat because he can't match the firepower. One of the things that we have advocated in the IACP is, one, that obviously assault weapons are the weapon of choice for criminals. 1994 weapons ban did result in a 66% reduction in assault weapons use.
Let me ask you and open this up for some further discussion. What, and let's look at what did happen at Sandy Hook. If I understand correctly, the killing weapon that was used is a Bushmaster AR-15. Am I saying that correctly? I'm not a weapons expert. Would that fall under the category of an assault weapon? It was a semi-automatic weapon, if I understand correctly. My larger point is to ask us to ask you all to discuss getting lost in terminology about types of weapons as opposed to and how that is going to drive the policy of keeping us all safe in our schools.
The short answer to that is we don't know. It's possible. It was even banned by the Connecticut state level assault weapons ban. But the way they define them is they'll just have a list of model names, and so if the manufacturer puts a slight change into the model name, it's not one of the banned guns anymore. So it depends on exactly what you think the real name is, and does it match up with that list in the Connecticut
assault. How can we address that, Chief McNeil?
Well, I think if you go back, what I think Professor is referring to is the 1994 ban and what was set up, and that was a two-prong application in terms of identifying an assault weapon. And he's right. In that legislation, they spoke of brands and that sort of thing. I think the legislation that's being proposed currently basically says that it's an assault weapon if it has a detachable magazine.
I'm going to interrupt you real quick to ask all of you to, if you could speak up or place the microphone a little closer to your mouth, that'll help the whole effort here. Sorry for my interruption.
No problem. If the definition would be a detachable magazine with 10 rounds or more, and then to meet one of those other, any of the other criteria, for example, did it have a bayonet attachment? Did it have a flash suppressor? any of the other identifiers would now qualify as an assault weapon.
Okay. We're going to come back to a number of the president's proposals in other areas, but Reverend Copeland, you wanted to jump in?
Well, I think working about the definition of an assault rifle and what is and what isn't, you're sort of begging the questions, it seemed to me. It is legal today for people to own semi-automatic weapons that can hold magazines that can contain up to 30 rounds, that can fire almost as fast as you can pull the trigger. And why are we worrying about the definition of this AR-15 rifle as opposed to another? Isn't there a more fundamental question? We have 300 million guns in America right now, almost one per every man, woman, and child in the country. Is this really the kind of world we want to live in? The homicide rate by gun in America is 35 times that of Great Britain. Shouldn't we be asking, perhaps crime is down in recent years, but compared to what? Compared to what other industrialized societies? It seems to me these are fundamental questions about how we want to be community together that we ought to be asking.
Yes, sir, Mr. Honkiar.
Super quick comment. I know the forum is related to gun violence. I'm concerned with all types of violence, gang violence, fist violence, whatever type it is. And in terms of school shootings or any types of shootings, and to the point, there's so many guns out there. The people that commit these crimes are not worried about the legality of anything. You'll find that they will be able to find these weapons, regardless of what law exists. So I think the responsible folks that own guns, myself included, family members, are not the main point. It's the point of the illegal owners, the illegal way they come into a criminal or a person who can put a devious plan together and carry it out to mine.
Reverend Copeland, as part of your response, you said, is this really the world we want to live in? Let me change a little bit our conversation to talk about that. Before December 14th, I had never heard of Newtown, Connecticut. I think that many of us were not familiar with the town of Newtown, Connecticut. The reporting that follows these tragedies almost invariably paints a picture of a community that has been peaceful and quiet and an expression of that it's so surprising that this could happen here. We didn't think that this could ever happen here. Let's talk about our community, not about Newtown, Connecticut. Let's talk about Tallahassee. Let's talk about Florida. I'm taking advantage of your position as a spiritual leader in our community. How can we think about that as a community? What kind of community are we? What is that a legitimate question for us to consider as part of this debate about mechanical guns, about crime? What kind of community are we? Is that part of the discussion we should be having, sir?
Well, I think it is, and I think being an American community, we are addicted to violence and especially gun violence. Look at our heroes, G.I. Joe, John Wayne, the brave Navy SEALs who swooped down and take out Osama bin Laden. After 9/11, our heroes were first responders. Now they seem to me to be mainly warriors of one description or another. I don't want to take anything away from those who serve so bravely. However, I think we have invited violence into our culture, and why should we be surprised that we can't protect our children from violence? I think we have some fundamental questions to ask ourselves about how we want to be community. And just being a peaceful community won't do it. The Amish of Lancaster, Pennsylvania in 2006, the most peaceful people you can imagine, and yet that didn't keep a person from coming in with a gun and shooting 10 school children, five of whom died. I think these are the fundamental questions we ought to be asking ourselves. And they're endemic to, the violence is endemic in our culture, has to do with our history, it has to do with the way we read the Second Amendment, and I don't think it's being read in the way that it that is an appropriate interpretation of it, and I'd like to, the rest of the panel to discuss that and get down to the fundamental questions that this raises. I don't want to debate about what is and isn't an assault rifle. A semi-automatic weapon that holds a magazine that has 30 rounds in it that a child could pick up and fire seems to me that's dangerous enough. And I think we have to ask ourselves a real question of whether we want to be a culture that proliferates with those kind of weapons.
Let me, I want to introduce, get Mr. Garcia to participate here, but also to respond to that as our, you get to be our resident legal expert this evening. Let's talk about the Second Amendment and where we are. We had a quick discussion ahead of time about U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have got us where we are. Perhaps it was in an email you sent me this afternoon. Let me set this up a little bit for purposes of discussion. For professional and personal reasons, I'm an absolutist on the First Amendment. I think that all speech needs to be free in order not to infringe on any of our speech. I admittedly have professional bias there. But I've thought a lot about this, and there, the folks who are support gun ownership, many of them also take an absolutist position of the Second Amendment. There are costs associated with taking a position of absolutism on free speech. There's some awfully ugly speech that I have to be willing to put up with in order to hold that position. There are costs associated with an absolutist position of the Second Amendment as well. But to help us, if you could, Mr. Garcia, about where we are with the evolution of Supreme Court decisions, if that's a fair question to ask of you.
Sure, Paul. Thank you. And I join the other panelists in thanking Village Square and the Democrat for putting this together. We're 40 minutes into this, and no one has read, frankly, the 27 words in the Second Amendment that matter. We're here exercising three of the First Amendment. We're assembling peacefully, the freedom of the press, and the freedom of speech. But the 27 words in the Second Amendment do matter, and here's what they say. And we all think we know them, but every time I read them, they sound just a little bit different.
Before you read it, I'm going to remind you to play like a rock star here and get that microphone right in, up
okay.
close to you.
It's a creed. Perhaps we could stand and say it together. That would be great.
As a recovering Catholic, I never argue with a Presbyterian priest. And the Supreme Court told us what this meant in 2008 in the Heller decision when they overturned the handgun ban in Washington, D.C. And there's moral issues, there's ethical issues, there's certainly fair differences of opinion policy-wise and philosophically, but the Constitution is our sacrosanct document that allows us to do what we're doing here tonight under the First Amendment. So the Second Amendment, which you can trace back to English law in the late 1600s, says a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. It probably could have been worded better, but the U.S. Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said in 2008 that protects an individual's right to bear arms. There was litigation about whether that just allowed the militia or our modern armies to have weapons. And they felt they were codifying what they call a pre-existing right dating back to even before our country was put together. So why is that important? We need no further evidence of how difficult the politics of this is, and that's what I do for a living. The United States Judiciary Committee today postponed their vote on the background check legislation because the good news is there's a bipartisan consensus emerging that these background checks do work. If you go to Walmart or somewhere else, a sporting goods store, Kevin's, or even a pawn shop, there is a background check. If apparently you go to the state fair, and we've either all seen the billboards or been there. Those are considered private sales or third-party sales. There either isn't one or it is not as stringent. So there seems to be the good news.
Well, let's talk about that, Dr. Clegg. That's another issue I wanted to hit, Mr. Garcia. But with background checks, do we have a number for what portion of gun transactions are happening that do not involve a background check at this time?
Well, the relevant issue is not what percent that is for everybody who gets a gun. The relevant one is among criminals, what percent is outside of the background checks. And the answer is probably on the order of 5 out of every 6 guns acquired by a criminal does not go through a background check, either because they stole the gun or they bought it from a friend or relative who may have stolen it or bought it from somebody else who stole it. We're working on is that remaining 1 in 6. The point is it's not zero. So background checks have some criminals who would have acquired a gun through one of those background check covered means of acquisition, and that's where there's a justification for extending the background checks to private transfers.
And Chief McNeil, this is key among the President's proposals that he has come out with, correct? And I presume that you would be in support of that change as well, yes?
Yes, but let me go back to the Supreme Court and Heller, because I don't want to have us misled on this, and I want to read this. Heller, however, it also is essential to note that the court made clear in Heller that the Second Amendment was not absolute and some gun control legislation is presumptively lawful, including laws that prohibit carrying concealed weapons, gun possessions by felons, are mentally ill, carrying firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings. So I just wanted to make sure it's clear that the Supreme Court did not say that bearing arms was an absolute.
Let me return us a bit around to, I want to return to you, Reverend Copeland, and ask a question about, Mr. Hunkyar mentioned he wanted to make sure we discuss mental health issues here. The chief just made reference to mental health exemptions to some Second Amendment rights. But apart from, how much are we talking about the symptoms as opposed to talking about the disease? How do we treat one to another in our communities, in Tallahassee? How does that bear on what we should be talking about with, I'll remind you, our reason for coming here today is to talk about keeping students safe and school safety and last, guns. So I'd like to keep us on that order of priority as well. You help people. You're in a helping profession. Is it fair to say that? How can we get along differently that might address this problem, as opposed to writing a new law, as opposed to funding for this program, as opposed to a different reading of the Constitution? Should that be part of our discussion as well?
I don't want to rule out those other things, but I think that is a part of the discussion. Last year in the Community Human Services Partnership process, the pool for funding for all human services was down by about 5%, and the requests were exceeded the available funds by over 50%. We had a mental health court in Tallahassee for about 3 years under a grant, and that, I understand, has run out, and the county commission has decided it just doesn't have the funds to keep that going. The primary mental health facilities in our community are 2, the shelter on Tennessee Street and the Leon County Jail. That seems to me an unacceptable way of caring for our neighbors, but it goes back to the professor's point. Are we willing to change our priorities and our commitment to public funding in order to address those issues? There's some fantastic mental health facilities in Tallahassee and some wonderful counselors and therapists, but I think it's pretty obviously they're not adequate to the need in our community.
Thank you. I appreciate you responding to that, my insistence that we talk about that. So I do want to have that discussion as a part of a community forum. Let me return to Mr. Hunkiar about what we may be doing going forward. The governor has made his budget recommendations to the legislature. Next Tuesday, the legislature convenes here in Tallahassee and will proceed on its 60-day march toward sine die. In the governor's recommended budget, he included an additional $10 million for school safety. It's a little fuzzy there with increased education funding. Perhaps districts would have more discretion to spend some money there. Is this a money question? And what is your understanding of where we may be going with that with state policy? And I'm going to next go to Mr. Garcia to give us the wisdom he has from over at the Capitol.
Our superintendent, Superintendent Pons, along with a few others, did speak to the Senate. And part of what they wanted to convey is that each community is different. Each community has different needs and may have different ideas for what they would do with additional funding. We're blessed here in Leon County that we've been proactive. We put a lot of things in place, obviously way before Sandy Hook, way before Nickel Mine, Pennsylvania, way before some of these other horrific events. Where we would go with that in terms of the additional dollars that we so desperately need in the areas of prevention. Preparedness is good. Response has always been good. If you look at these horrific events, and they have been studied at length, the United States Secret Service did a study and reviewed every school shooting over the last, I believe, 30 or 40 years. And there was one common finding, is that in every one of these events, somebody knew something that could have prevented it or helped it. That's the fix, or that's the immediate direction that we hope those dollars go to. I believe these things are prevented in the family. I believe they're prevented in the community. And I am very confident that our classroom teachers, our counselors, our assistant principals and principals are preventing things every day. They may have prevented one of these terrible things we may not never know. Hopefully we're preventing teen suicide. Hopefully we're preventing student-on-student violence. But where those dollars need to go are into a lot of the prevention activities. And I'd like to say one more thing. School districts in Florida used to receive per-student funding amount for programs for prevention, proven research-based proven programs. I last managed that grant, and the dollar amount for a district like Leon County was about $120,000. If you can take $120,000 and apply it to 50 facilities with great success, then please give me a call. I'd like to have you on board. But those monies have all become competitive. And that's very difficult because for a competitive program, you're looking at about a two-year cycle by the time you compete, award, and move forward. So those monies, as they come, like I said, I believe most districts will have different needs, and I think that's important. They should. Those superintendents and those principals should be able to apply it where they feel best with community input.
Mr. Garcia, as I said, we're about to start the legislative session up there. There are about half dozen, eight school safety bills up there. Some of them address funding that Mr. Hunkiar raises, trying to find a dedicated source of funding for school safety programs. The governor's budget does have, as I mentioned, that extra $10 million for school safety. Is there a vibe in the halls of the Capitol about what may or may not be happening related to school safety in particular? In the immediate aftermath of Sandy Hook, there's always, as our discussion has reflected, discussion about gun regulation. those are two separate things, and I want to address them separately, and then we're going to move to some questions here shortly, so bear with us, please. But can you, are you able to give us an update of the situation as we enter session season?
Sure, and I've had the privilege of lobbying the legislature for about 20 years, and for the professionals, we've been in session for the last 6 weeks. They've been voting on stuff. I see law enforcement folks here, judges here, elected officials here, community leaders here. The governor does recommend a budget, and that's his or her prerogative. The legislature takes some of that under advisement. They develop their own priorities. There's a sentiment that maybe the governor spent about $500 million more than the legislators think they're going to spend. The governor's top priority is to do raises for teachers, I believe $2,500 per teacher, which has a very substantial price tag. So our local Senator Bill Montfort is the vice chair of the Education Appropriations Committee, a former school superintendent, and the head of the School Superintendents Association. So I think if the superintendents and the sheriffs, frankly, fight for it politically, it's got a better chance. But I think the reality is that there will be something. It won't be that much. There may be pilot programs. There may be grants. But I think there's a feeling that the local folks know what works best. And then I think there's a sense, and maybe this is a misperception, that there already are school resource officers that are collaborative efforts with city police and county sheriffs that the school districts can already use, and many of them do. And I think it's common sense that that has that visibility has a deterrent effect. So the short answer is it's too early. It'll be a negotiated item, like almost everything else is over there. But they are going fast and furious. They've been here for committee meetings for 6 weeks and are really going to hit the ground running hard on Tuesday.
Let me quickly, Chief McNeil, one more element that we can't I'd like to get to about proposals. And Dr. Kleck, perhaps this is an area where you can help us as well. Magazine size. Adam Lanza went through 30 bullet magazines, if I understand correctly, in Sandy Hook. This is a concern that's been raised by President Obama. What difference does that make on the streets and in our safety? And then if I can ask afterward if Dr. Kleck could weigh in if there's any connection between magazine size and violence that we face in the United States. Chief?
Well, we believe there is, particularly in terms of the amount of carnage that can occur on the streets of our cities, particularly when officers are going against, and that's what we're asking our officers to do, is to go against militarily armed persons when we're not militarily armed ourselves, keeping in mind that about 70% of the law enforcement agencies in this country look like Quincy. They don't look like New York City, and they don't look like Tallahassee, quite frankly, and don't have the wherewithal to deal with that reality, i.e. Newton. Now, what was the other question?
Actually, if we can, let's segue to Dr. Kleck, and if you can offer us any analysis of what magazine size, where it plays into this question.
Usually when people say it's a good idea to limit magazine capacity, what they have most in mind is mass shootings like the Newtown case. The rationale being that killer needed large capacity magazines to injure or kill as many people as he did, and if he had a smaller capacity magazine, fewer people would have been hurt. But the explicit reasoning behind that is rarely made. There's no real difference in terms of how many shots you can fire between three 10-round magazines, and that's what would be allowed under the new legislation, versus a single 30-round magazine. It takes 2 to 4 seconds to change magazines in a semi-automatic gun. So what exactly is produced by adding that 2 to 4 second time to reload? And the argument usually is, well, if any argument is explicitly made at all, is maybe some bystander or potential victim will intervene. They'll tackle the guy in that 2 to 4 second interval. The problem is, with one exception, it's never actually happened, even though in mass shooting after mass shooting, people, in fact, you know, did have that opportunity. But people are scared. They're terrified. They're running away from that shooter. They're trying to distance themselves as much as possible. So that's not what happens. Even in the Phoenix, Arizona shooting where a congresswoman was shot, it was claimed that somebody had tackled the guy, but in fact he was only tackled after he had stopped shooting and was leaving the scene. The only time somebody actually took advantage of that reloading interval in a mass shooting occurred on a New England commuter train when people couldn't distance themselves from the shooter because they were on a train car. And so after the guy had reloaded once or twice, he finally was tackled, but that's once. That's the only time in history. And so, and then the other 99% of non-mass shootings, it's basically people fire a handful of rounds. They don't fire even 10, never mind 30 or 90 or whatever is involved in mass shootings.
If I could, if you ask a police officer who comes in contact with a person with a 50-round weapon and the ability to reload, whether seconds count, I guarantee you they count. And the issue, quite honestly, we go back and forth on this with respect to what happened in Connecticut. And we say we don't want to focus exclusively on that, but we pretty much make the conversation about that. And I'm trying to make this from my perspective, from the police chief's perspective. This is a safety issue for all of us, not merely in terms, and it's tragic what happened at the school, but this is a tragedy that can occur anywhere in America, and our police officers at the front line of trying to protect us when we don't have those same resources ourselves.
Reverend Copeland.
I have to make one comment on that, because the chief has mentioned officer safety a number of times. If, in fact, the large magazines mean the criminals outgun the cops, then you ought to have some cases where cops ran out of bullets because they didn't have as many rounds to fire as the criminals did. It just doesn't happen that way. No, it doesn't happen that way. In the vast majority of instances where police officers are killed, they don't even fire one round, never mind empty their magazines and run out of ammunition. Police don't get killed in shootouts for the most part. They get killed by a guy whipping out his gun unanticipated, and he shoots that officer right off the bat without him having any opportunity to engage him in a firefight.
Reverend Copeland.
I just want to ask what seems to me a common sense question. If it's the case that most times three or four rounds are fired, why do we need guns that fire 30 rounds? It defies logic for me to understand why a person needs a gun with that kind of capacity, and how that's, I acknowledge the individual's right, but don't we have to balance the individual's right over against the common good for the rest of us?
Well, in fact, you don't need it. Criminals don't need it, and non-criminals don't need it, and cops don't need it. In fact, it's irrelevant to all of those people. It's irrelevant to how much bad the bad guys do and how much good the good guys do. The truth is, the only reason why people have large capacity magazines is because they want to, and they get some fun out of it. I mean, 99.99% of the magazines are owned by people who have them for recreational reasons. And why do they have them? Is it for any serious purpose? No, they like shooting lots of rounds without reloading, and there's no more justification than that.
Let me get back to... I'm going to use this as a segue to start introducing some questions from the audience. This is a question I had, so we're both really smart, whoever asked this question. Dr. Kleck and Chief McNeil, I believe that the president's proposals also include two separate requests for appropriations of $10 million each for Centers of Disease Control studies, National Institutes of Health studies on guns and violence. I frankly don't know precisely what the funding request was however, for research studies into gun ownership and the connection to violence. Dr. Kleck, is there a need for funding to get us more data, and would that help us?
Yeah, it would help us, because the main limitation on the existing background checks, let's assume we do the wise thing and we extend it to cover private transfers. The problem is the records that are available for the record checkers to examine are grossly incomplete, in particular mental health records. So there are people out there who not only are emotionally disturbed, but they're violent, and they shouldn't have any kind of gun of any sort, but the people who do the background checks don't have any comprehensive or even remotely comprehensive list of people like that. Even the ones who have been officially defined by a court of law as a danger to themselves and others, like the shooter in the Virginia Tech mass shooting. And so, yeah, money would help, although a lot of the problem has nothing to do with money. It's law that's standing in the way. We're a federalist system. The federal government cannot force states to expand their coverage of mental health records. There are state laws which are intended to cover the privacy of psychiatric patients, which say you cannot share those records with other people, including background checkers. And so that those laws are going to have to be amended in order to allow more sharing of that information. And then it'll be possible to do something with the additional dollars that might be available to improve the computer record keeping. But most of our records on that, they start in local courts, like the Leon County Circuit Court, and those guys are going to have to pass the information on up to higher levels before it's available finally to the FBI to actually check the records. They're going to have to join the 21st century in their record keeping and in their sharing of the information and in producing it in a form that's actually usable by so our computers can talk to their computers.
Mr. Garcia, I think the lobbyists for the clerks of court could use Dr. Kleck over at the Capitol to get some more increased funding there.
The governor has the power with the consent of two cabinet members under the Constitution to grant mercy. And what does that mean? One of them is firearm authority. But it's very interesting. We were talking before off stage. I had a 16-year-old kid that was getting bullied at school in Miami, and I'm not sure 10 deputies would have prevented this. He went home, and he wouldn't go to school for 3 days. His mother said, "You've got to go to school." He went to school. He got his dad's loaded gun, I think, just to scare the bully. There was an incident. You know where I'm going with this. The weapon went off, killed the bully, my 16-year-old kid, and the Supreme Court has said, a very conservative Supreme Court has said in three cases, the brain science, their brain's not finished maturing till they're 25, so we have to have special considerations for juveniles. He was charged with first-degree murder, which was overkill. I always thought it was a manslaughter case. There was a mistrial, charged with second-degree murder and convicted of manslaughter, and is serving 30 years in prison. Now, that's a different issue, and that's a different forum, bullying. And the professor and I were talking a little bit about mandatory minimum sentences that take discretion away from judges. But I'm not sure in that situation any number of appropriations or any number of programs, he was going in his mind to defend himself and back this bully off, and it just completely escalated. It ties into the mental health issues.
That will have to be the last word for the recorded portion of our program tonight. You can view the rest of the program online at tallahassee.com or listen to the audio at tothevillagesquare.org. This was recorded live at St. John's Episcopal Church in downtown Tallahassee. On behalf of the Tallahassee Democrat and the Village Square, thank you for joining us and good night.
Join us again for another visit to the Village Square on WFSU-FM.